Getting to know you, getting to know all about you. Getting to like you, getting to hope you like me.
Chairman Kim and I just signed a joint statement in which he reaffirmed his unwavering commitment to complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
We had a historic meeting and decided to leave the past behind. The world will see a major change.
My meeting with Chairman Kim was honest, direct, and productive.
It's not a big deal to meet. I think we should meet on a lot of different topics, not just this one. I hope it's good, because if it is, we're going to solve a very big problem. I think we've gone a long way to solving it today. I think he wants to make a deal. Can anybody be certain?
I may be wrong. I mean, I may stand before you in 6 months and say, hey, I was wrong. I don't know that I'll ever admit that, but I'll find some kind of an excuse.
We're prepared to start a new history, and we're ready to write a new chapter between our nations.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway, and it was a made-for-TV moment from our reality star president. On Tuesday, the president of the United States, Donald Trump, and the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, met for the first time ever in Singapore. The highly anticipated summit lasted several hours, including 1 hour just between the two leaders and their translators, and an expanded meeting with aides from both sides. Suki Kim is a contributing editor for The New Republic and the author of Without You, There Is No Us, Undercover Among the Sons of North Korea's Elite, and she joins us now from Singapore. Hi, Suki.
Hi, Tanzina.
So we're hearing from a lot of critics that this summit was more about propaganda and show versus being about actual outcomes. What do you say? You're on the ground in Singapore.
Well, I mean, summits should be about an issue that gets agreed, and here there really is absolutely nothing. All, what there is a gigantic show, because there are over 3,000 journalists covering this event.
In terms of the specifics of this agreement or this document, have the two parties even decided what the same criteria would be for something like denuclearization, or are we still up in the air without specifics?
All of it is the same. You know, denuclearization is something that has come up from the beginning. The U.S. said that they will never agree to anything without a complete verifiable denuclearization. And still the terms are North Korea is going to work towards denuclearization. So, I mean, there's literally nothing. I mean, that's what I'm telling you is basically what's the agreement, right? And then also this whole U.S. promising safety of the regime in North Korea. I mean, how do you even guarantee that? Like, that is also another thing that nobody understands. How does one nation guarantee the other nation's regime? So what I'm amazed by being here, there's just no clarification. The mystifying element of this summit that everybody kept asking, why is it happening? What's it about? What are they going to agree on? Those questions remained exactly the same.
Now, you mentioned guaranteeing the regime would stay in place. One of the things that President Trump was asked about was about the thousands of North Koreans in detention camps and gulags. And I want to play a clip from you and see your reaction to that.
Things will change. I think I've helped them. There's nothing I can say. All I can do is do what I can do. We have to stop the nuclearization. We have to do other things, and that's a very important thing. So at a certain point, hopefully you'll be able to ask me a much more positive question or make a statement. But not much I can do right now. At a certain point, I really believe he's going to do things about it. I think they are one of the great winners today, that large group of people that you're talking about. I think ultimately they're going to be one of the great winners.
Suki, your response.
I mean, I don't understand. It's just hard to make sense of what he's saying. Human rights issues are, you know, it's the most devastating issue in the contemporary world, North Korea at the moment. Why is it certain that the North Korean leader will do better? I mean, it's been 70-some years, and their record is the worst in the world. There's nothing that would make anybody feel that they are going to get better. And by having this summit, actually, we've just legitimized the most brutal nation in the world into the world stage. So on human rights issue, nothing was done today. And this summit has actually brought it to another level, into a worst place.
And you're there on the ground. What's the perspective that you're hearing from other South Koreans, North Koreans, other folks in Singapore about this?
I have to say, in general, South Koreans are more optimistic. And that has a lot to do with the South Korean politics at the moment. And they just want peace on their peninsula. So it's not even politically induced. I mean, they're just right now, they're just happy that there's a meeting between these two leaders and nothing really beyond that. I think in the international sector, there's far more cynicism. In reality, you know, this was a big show. And honestly, what it felt like was just as if two big superstar celebrities were meeting. You know, the paparazzi and movie star, that's kind of what it was, because there's no real agreement. And these two are the biggest showmen in the world. And so we've seen really, I mean, when you're talking about the reality TV, that's kind of what we saw.
Suki Kim is a contributing editor for The New Republic and the author of Without You, There Is No Us, Undercover Among the Sons of North Korea's Elite. Thanks, Suki.
Thank you.
We now turn to Bill Richardson. He's a former governor of New Mexico and a former UN ambassador. He watched this summit unfold with the unique eye of someone who himself has negotiated with North Korea. Governor Richardson, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Tansina.
So let's dive right in. Based on what we know so far, what was your overall reaction to the summit?
Well, on the optics, on the personal connection between the two leaders, on the normalization of relations, on lessening tensions in the peninsula, I would say the summit was positive, historic in that sense. On the negative mix side, very little what the North Koreans gave up. No commitments on denuclearization, on ballistic missiles, just a promise to negotiate. Very little mention of verification and inspections, which in the past have led the North Koreans to basically cheat on previous agreements. The concessions that we have made, reduction military exercises, security guarantees for North Korea, in other words, not try to depose Kim Jong-un, I think are appropriate, but I would have wanted the North Koreans to give up something tangible, and they really didn't. But we are starting a process. I think the devil's in the details. The jury's out.
Now, the two leaders did sign a document. It's unclear how binding that document is. Can you give us some insight into that?
Well, you know, this happens at summits between presidents and leaders, and then they're either followed through or not. My worry is that the document is not binding. It doesn't have timelines. It doesn't have commitments. It doesn't have legs. It doesn't have verification, just commitments to negotiate. Now, the positive side is that the Secretary of State, Pompeo, has met Kim Jong-un twice. He's been to North Korea. He salvaged the summit. So he, I assume, will assemble a team to talk about the important issues here, missiles, nuclear weapons, their destruction, their freezing of these technologies to hit the United States, Japan, South Korea. I would have wanted a little more discussion on human rights in North Korea. There was very little mention, although the president did mention something that's very important to me, and that is the return of remains of our soldiers from the Korean War. And I brought seven of those remains back in 2007 during the Bush administration. So that's positive. But again, nothing tangible, no meat on the bones on that issue.
And Governor, you've negotiated with North Korea in the past. What was your expectation? Did you see what you expected to see from Kim Jong-un?
Well, I expected more in terms of the nuclear and ballistic missile side, because Kim Jong-un himself was directly involved. But the familiar pattern emerged again when I negotiated with the North Koreans. They never say yes. They always want you to take the first step. They're vague on commitments and timelines. And this is what happened again. But I'm not saying the summit on the negotiating of ballistic missiles and nuclear is failed. we'll wait and see. Let's see what happens. I think there's a negotiating process that is emerging with significantly less tension than has occurred before. So the jury's out, but, you know, I give them the benefit of the doubt to do the best they can.
So I guess I'm wondering if you see, there have been some critics that said the United States is basically giving North Korea a platform and basically playing into its own propaganda machine with this summit. Do you, it sounds like you don't agree with that.
Well, I do think that North Korea is going to use the summit as a great platform in North Korea to solidify Kim Jong-un's leadership role there. It's going to make Kim Jong-un a player on the world stage, being on the par with the American president. Yeah, I think it was a concession, but it's a concession that I think was risky, but correct. The past had not yielded any results, negotiating from the bottom up with special negotiators, ambassadors. So it was worth the risk. But yeah, North Korea ends up looking very good and giving up very little in this summit.
Well, and I also wonder if the tone, I mean, we know that the president has a pretty casual tone, if you will, in many of these press conferences. And he did sort of make a flip comment about perhaps changing his mind in a couple of months. He made a comment about North Korea's beautiful beaches and how they would be good real estate potential. What do you make of that? I mean, does that lessen the seriousness of this at all?
Well, you know, the president has his own unique negotiating style, much of it that I don't approve of, you know, with tweets and taunts and, you know, these meltdowns. You know, he's not going to change. So an institutional process needs to evolve and not just leave everything to, you know, presidential statements and then have a unified message led by the Department of State and Secretary Pompeo instead of all these other individuals commenting.
Bill Richardson is a former governor of New Mexico and former UN ambassador. Governor Richardson, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
From the start, President Trump was ambitious about using the summit with Kim Jong-un to push for the denuclearization of North Korea. But many who've escaped life under the regime hope that Trump would use the meeting to challenge North Korea over what the United Nations has described as systemic, widespread, and gross human rights violations. Yunmi Park is one of those people. She escaped from North Korea when she was just 13, and just before today's summit, she told me that she thought Trump might be the right person to take on North Korea.
Because previous administrations had this policy called strategic patience. Means shamefully not going to do anything about the human rights abuses or whatever the dictator is doing. But the thing is, the unpredictability he has. And the problem with North Korea is that when they go low, we went high. And it doesn't work with North Korea. When they go low, you have to go low too.
When they go low, you have to go low too. Yunmi said she was very supportive of President Trump. She was impressed that he could bring a dictator like Kim Jong-un to the negotiating table. But she's disappointed that today's summit had virtually no focus on human rights abuses.
What a hypocrite, these people saying they believe in justice, they believe in human rights, they believe in human dignity. And how are you standing for all those values and go completely against what we believe in here? These people should know what injustice looks like. And they're not going to bring that up. Then why are they even going to North Korea? I mean, why am I going to this summit and meeting this dictator and legitimizing him?
Yunmi told me why human rights must be at the center of any diplomatic conversation with Kim Jong-un.
The people in North Korea, we don't care if we have nukes or not. We are starving. We are not free. We are being persecuted. We have no freedom of speech. So what people want in North Korea is food and have freedom. And there's no concentration camp. So I am not hopeful. And this is a day of tragedy if really North Korea tricks Trump saying that he will remove nukes gradually, which will take years. And by then, the Trump will be out of his term. Then North Korea can always go back to have more nukes. And then people will be continuously oppressed and being killed by this dictator. So it is saddening to me. There is even a possibility one day the dictator is normalized a person and a leader and is attending the international summits along with other leaders as just normal person. He's a murderer.
Does there have to be a step forward at some point? And could this summit be the first step in some sort of diplomacy, considering that the lack of diplomacy has partially resulted in what you're talking about, the lack of food, the imposition of sanctions?
That's completely false. In 2000, when I was, I think, 7 or 8 years old, when I was in North Korea, there was a president from South Korea who initiated a peace talk and who gave millions of cash, tons of aid to North Korean regime, and we thought the reunification coming. And the person, the South Korean president, Kim Dae-sung, who initiated the peace talk, he won the Nobel Prize. So if that worked, if that diplomacy and the helping North Korea worked, why North Korea is here today? So with North Korea, we are not dealing with the normal regime. And what the talks can achieve, because all the politicians, what they have done is talking. That's why we are here today. That's why North Korean people are being starving and getting killed in the concentration camps. So I don't believe just talking to North Korea out of sake of like diplomacy will not solve this tragedy.
What do you expect, or how do you expect to meet the goal that you're saying, which is to feed the North Korean people without diplomacy, with lessening sanctions? How do you see that happening?
So maximum pressure. That's what got Kim Jong-un out of these two conversations. The Trump's president, maximum pressure definitely worked. So we cannot let North Korean regime to trade with any other regimes or the countries to get the cash for them. So imagine if we talk to China and China cuts all the gas and the oil, every supply that they provide to this dictator alive. Then if that nothing comes into country, how Kim Jong-un is going to rule a country? He can't. So as much as we can in the policy-wise, we should continue the maximum pressure. And the other way, we have to empower people. And also there's a way to get information inside North Korea through smugglers. And we have to let North Korean people know that they are slaves. And the leader they believe as a god, that's a dictator. And we have to make North Korean people to demand their freedom. Because if you don't know you're slaves, how do you demand to be free? And that's a problem in North Korea. It's not because people in North Korea are not able to think. They are brainwashed. They don't have information. There's only one channel on TV. People are not free to speak. So solution is not talking to Kim Jong-un and talk about nukes, because that will continue to kill us.
Right. But the solution, I mean, the solution that you're proposing, educating North Koreans about their current status, potentially, what, overthrowing the North Korean regime?
Dismantle this regime, yeah.
But dismantling that has to have some element in diplomacy, does it not?
He needs to ask the North Korea to open up the concentration camps. It might be worse than Nazi Germany during the Holocaust. That's happening to North Korea, and that's a guy Trump is considering having a normalized diplomatic relationship. So if North Korea really comes to the table today and saying they are going to open up the concentration camps, they are going to let the international community come, the Red Cross, UN, World Food, all of them come and feed people and do all the investigation, then I will believe that diplomacy worked.
Do you still have family in North Korea?
Yes.
Can you tell us anything about them?
So since I spoke out, I spoke about the starvation, execution, human rights abuses, and then North Korea came after me and they used all my relatives back in North Korea to put them on the YouTube video. You can search right now. And then my relatives denounced me as an enemy of the people. And they tell me I'm the propaganda puppet of the West. And they disappeared after that.
Your relatives disappeared?
Yeah.
Meaning?
I don't know if they got killed or they sent to concentration camps. I don't know how to find them again. So I am almost waiting for North Korean regime to put another propaganda video using them. And unfortunately, that's the only way for me to check if they're alive or not. So I'm saying, I'm not free. Even the dictator, till this day, after my escape, after I became a free person, he controls me. And he assassinated, defected, I mean, he killed his own half-brother. And this is the guy we are talking about. What do you mean? There's a one day possibly we are going to have a normal diplomatic relationship with this Hitler. I mean, I don't know what kind of world that I have to raise my son and saying that's normal. And this is something that I did not expect that I, when I risked my life to be free.
Yunmi Park is a human rights activist and the author of In Order to Live, A North Korean Girl's Journey to Freedom. Yunmi, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And if you have any thoughts on the Singapore summit, give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Around 20,000 people are granted asylum in the United States every year, but that number could soon drop dramatically. On Monday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions ordered immigration judges to stop granting asylum to victims of domestic abuse and gang violence. He made the announcement at the immigration judges conference.
The asylum system is being abused to the detriment of the rule of law, sound public policy, public safety even, and to the detriment of people with just claims to asylum.
Elise Foley is an immigration and politics reporter for HuffPost, and she joins me now. Elise, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. Thanks for being with us. Tell us, how deep does this go? I mean, what were the rules regarding asylum and domestic violence, and how does this order change those?
Sure. So it's somewhat recent. In 2014, the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is sort of like the Supreme Court, although Jeff Sessions is kind of the Supreme Court of immigration courts, they decided that domestic violence could be sort of considered more strongly for asylum cases. So they made it a precedent that women who suffer domestic violence can't escape their partners, can receive asylum on that basis. And since then, that's been a huge, huge deal for especially women from Central America who are in countries where police and governments aren't really protecting them, who come here and seek help. So we've seen that happen a lot in the past few years. A lot of people are using that past precedent to apply for asylum. And now basically Jeff Sessions is saying that generally that is not grounds for asylum and that that is true for victims of gang violence as well. So I think that this is very, very targeted at stopping asylum for Central Americans. You have to look at this in the context of the family separations that are going on at the border, the talk about a border wall, the talk about the need to close asylum, what they call loopholes, what the administration calls loopholes, through Congress. And basically, the administration is doing everything it can to crack down on people coming to the U.S. without authorization. And we're not just talking about people crossing the border illegally. We're also talking about a lot of asylum seekers who come to ports of entry, perfectly legal, go up and say that they have fear of returning to their home countries. And the Trump administration has basically said to them that we don't want you to do that, whether it's legal or not.
So we have a clip from Sessions talking about this issue from KTAR Radio in Arizona last month. I'd like to play that for you and get your reaction.
We've had situations in which a person comes to the United States and says they are a victim of domestic violence, therefore they're entitled to enter the United States. Well, that's obviously false, but some judges have gone along with that.
What would you say to that?
Well, it's an interesting thing because he says it's obviously false. That is very much forecasting the ultimate decision he made yesterday. But immigration judges, attorneys who made the decision that it was not false. It was the precedent that women could get asylum on the basis of domestic violence. And we're not talking in every case. They had to prove that, you know, they weren't able to escape their husband or partner within the country. It wasn't a sure thing at all in the way he made it sound to be, but it was judges who determined that. So it was not obviously false. It's a very interesting thing in immigration courts that they're not like regular courts where it's part of an independent judicial branch. They're part of the Department of Justice. So Sessions or any attorney general can basically just trump what other judges believe. And so to him, I guess that's the obvious interpretation of the law. Now, at this point, that is the precedent. but it was not the case before that, you know, these women were doing something wrong.
I'm speaking with Elise Foley, immigration and politics reporter for HuffPost, and we're talking about the new changes to the asylum process in the United States. Elise, is this a human rights violation of some sort, or does this sort of go against who we are as a country to deny entry to these folks?
Well, certainly Jeff Sessions wouldn't say so. I went to his remarks yesterday before immigration judges, and he talked about how this is just about applying the law more consistently, that this is important and it actually is helpful because now people won't come who shouldn't come. But, you know, under international law, the U.S. and any country that signed on to those human rights conventions is supposed to offer asylum to people based on persecution under certain grounds. And so he's saying that this doesn't fit into that. I think that there are a lot of people who strongly disagree. These efforts to deter asylum seekers, the Trump administration has kind of skirted around saying that that's what they're trying to do with this or family separation. But Sessions said repeatedly yesterday that, you know, he thinks will stop people from coming.
Well, but that seems to be the goal, right? To stop people from coming regardless of whether they need to come. And I think that's the question I wanted to ask you was in 2017, 62% of asylum cases were denied. Is this really necessary?
Yeah, that was one thing that was very interesting is he said actually the number was even higher of the rejection. So it's not like asylum is this very, very easy thing to get, but they've made pretty clear that they would rather that people not come here and get it. The DHS Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen has said people should stay in Mexico if they have asylum claims. So I think that the message here is we don't want you, asylum seekers. And I think, yeah, a lot of people would say that that's very contrary to American values.
And that could also be dangerous to people who are seeking an asylum for these reasons.
Absolutely. And I think it'll be interesting to see. But I think when people are desperate, I suspect people will leave their country regardless of what, you know, the Trump administration says, if they're scared to be at home.
Elise Foley is an immigration and politics reporter for HuffPost. Elise, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. It helps us in ways you can't imagine. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter and they'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win. All right, now back to the show.
This is The Takeaway here at the bottom of the hour. I'm Tanzina Vega. Five states hold primaries today: Nevada, North Dakota, South Carolina, Virginia, and Maine. But it's the last one we'll focus on for now.
Hi guys, it's Jen Lawrence. Did you know that there's an election coming up on June 12th? It's so important to get out and vote yes on question one to protect ranked choice voting.
That's actor Jennifer Lawrence weighing in on today's state election in Maine. It's a vote that's being closely watched around the country, and not because of any political candidate. Today actually marks the first attempt in the United States to use a process called ranked choice voting in a statewide election. But that could be short-lived. Cynthia Dill is a lawyer, Maine news analyst, and former Democratic Maine state senator and representative. Cynthia, welcome.
Hello.
So the idea of ranked choice voting doesn't sound very fun, but is this sort of like an algorithm? What is it?
It's a method to determine the winner of an election by a majority as opposed to a plurality. And so there are candidates on a ballot and voters will rank them by preference. So if you had three candidates, say red, blue, and yellow, and after the first count, none of the candidates had a 50% majority, but yellow was the least, you know, he or she got the least amount of votes. Well, if I had voted for yellow as my first choice, yellow would be eliminated because, you know, he got the least number of votes. And then my second choice, say I had voted blue for second, my blue vote would then get distributed to the blue candidate. So everyone who voted for yellow, who lost in the first round, their second choice would then get redistributed. And that would keep happening in round after round until somebody gets more than 50% of the vote.
So how and why did Maine end up with this system?
There had been attempts to implement ranked choice voting system legislatively because groups such as the League of Women Voters and other government reform groups think it's a good way to go. But it was the election of our governor, Paula Page, first in 2010 and then again in 2014, with less than 50% of the vote that really, I think, lit a fire under a group of people that were largely supporting Elliot Cutler in the gubernatorial race. He was an independent candidate. So although ranked choice voting is not about a particular candidate, in Maine, it really is a response to a particular candidate, and that candidate is our Governor Paula Page. So the Republicans in Maine have been opposed, fiercely opposed. There's been several lawsuits. They claim that using ranked choice voting is unconstitutional, but also will prevent a conservative from being elected.
Now, how has this played out in the last couple of months within the state? And what do you expect the results of this will be in Maine?
It's been very turbulent and exciting. There's been at least three lawsuits. The Maine Law Court has given an advisory opinion saying that ranked choice voting is unconstitutional as it applies to certain elections and not others. So there's been a lot of energy and media attention on the issue. We're expecting in today's primary a high turnout. So my prediction is that ranked choice voting will be utilized mostly by the Democrats, but in addition to electing our nominees for governor with this process, as well as a few other races, there's also a ballot question that deals with ranked choice voting that will either, I think, give it thumbs up or thumbs down whether we're going to have a future with ranked choice voting. So there's an incentive for people who are not going to participate in partisan primaries to come out to vote today because they can affirm on the question one by voting yes to continue to use ranked choice voting.
Cynthia Dill is a lawyer, Maine news analyst, and a former Democratic Maine state senator and representative. Cynthia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Last December, the Federal Communications Commission voted to roll back Obama-era net neutrality rules. The rules basically said that internet service providers like AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon had to treat all internet traffic the same way. Providers were not allowed to favor specific websites or content or block or slow down some types of content in favor for others. The reaction from many Americans was swift and largely one of concern. Americans left millions of comments on the FCC's website. But as of yesterday morning, net neutrality is dead, at least for now. So what does the future of the internet look like? Russell Brandom is a senior reporter at The Verge, and he's here to talk us through it all. Russell, thanks for being here in studio with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So let's talk about how long this took to happen. We kind of knew this was coming, but here officially.
Well, we knew that it was coming in that the current head of the FCC has not been a fan of net neutrality rules for a while. When Trump was elected, the writing was sort of on the wall. He was going to be in charge and he was going to do something. I think some people were maybe a little bit surprised at how aggressive the rule was. This really rolls back not just the Obama era stuff, but a lot of the, you know, what was happening throughout the 2000s. There was a lot of sort of court cases. This really takes us all the way back to like 1996, when there were really no restrictions at all on what carriers could do.
So let's break this down for our listeners. So as of now, this ruling is basically saying, and correct me if I'm wrong here, if I am an internet service provider, I can offer you packages, different internet packages, and if you want to pay more for better service, you'll be able to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably more what we're likely to see. So right now, there are deals with wireless carriers, and this was something that wasn't explicitly forbidden by the Obama-era rules, but they were sort of moving towards cracking down on it. But if I'm an AT&T customer and I use AT&T for my phone service, and I'm also buying cable television from AT&T, which they're through their DirecTV service, I can stream that DirecTV to my phone and it won't count against my data cap, which is great because streaming video takes up a lot of data.
Sure.
Usually, if I was watching Netflix, I would get this huge phone bill at the end of the month. But because DirecTV is owned by AT&T, they say, all right, that's fine. Now, I think people see this as maybe a little bit of an unfair leg up. Why should Netflix be disadvantaged to DirecTV in this way? Are we going to see something like that with wireline internet? Are we going to see, you know, maybe right now the standard is sort of unlimited data on wired internet. That's a thing people expect? Are we going to see more and more services sort of paying to be exempt from that, and then maybe when you buy it, there's a data cap, but it's okay because you're using these services that are exempt? That's something that is allowed under the new rules. We don't know if that's going to happen. And it also may be that they say, you know what, you can watch Netflix, but it's using so much bandwidth that for our network, it's really important that it not, we're just going to give you this sort of throttled version of it where the pic, you know, the image quality isn't as good. It won't use as much data. But if you watch this DirecTV one, it'll be great. It'll look wonderful because, you know, we can arrange it. We can arrange the data flows in this way that's easier for us. That's also something that would have explicitly not been allowed a few days ago and is now basically allowed. We don't know how much carriers are going to do on this. We don't know how aggressively they're going to act. But that is certainly something that they are thinking about.
How is this, what's this going to look like for the consumer ultimately? Now, if somebody logs on to the internet, you know, in the coming weeks or months, are they suddenly going to see a change, a visual change? Are they going to be aware of that change?
I don't think we're going to see anything change on the scale of weeks or months. I would say that if anything, this is the next time you are signing up for an internet deal. And I mean, you know, people are probably familiar with this process. You move into a new apartment, maybe, and they say, oh, actually, well, we would give you this great deal if you also got cable TV and also got landline phone service. And,
I'm still stuck in the triple play. Don't even.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I still have a landline that I
it's
don't
terrible.
Use. Yeah.
I think probably just getting internet access, that contract is going to start looking more complicated. And maybe it's going to be bundled with various content deals. Maybe it's going to be bundled with certain sort of services taking up more data cap space than others. And just that bill is going to start looking more complicated and potentially complicated in a way that's not really fair to consumers.
Russell Brandum is a senior reporter at Verge. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I never dreamed you'd leave in summer.
Summer is not actually here yet. I know, we've still got more than a week until the official summer solstice. But with vacations or staycations beginning, it's a good time to get a jump on some relaxing. After all, summer is the perfect time to crack open a great book. And if you're in need of a summer reading list, we're here to help. Mythili Rao is a producer at the New Yorker Radio Hour, a Takeaway alum, and book critic. So, Mythili, it's been a grim year for news in so many ways. Are publishers and authors responding?
Certainly. I mean, I think it's an exciting time as ever for publishing. You know, people are always saying the novel is dying or dead, and it continues to survive and thrive.
So you have six books with you here. Let's talk about the first one, Asymmetry by Lisa Halliday.
There's a gossipy reason why people are talking about this book this summer, and that is because when Lisa Halliday was a little younger, she had a relationship with Philip Roth, and readers see elements of this in the book. But that's not really the only reason to read this book. It does add a sort of element of juiciness, I suppose, but Lisa Halliday really knows how to write. This book combines two very distinct plot lines in a totally unexpected way. And from the first page, you're in really good hands.
And Philip Roth just passed away.
Right.
So does that, do you see this sort of adding to the interest in this book?
I think so. I have seen mention of this book in obituaries of his and in sort of essays about his life. And it's a completely different way into thinking about his life.
Book number two is There, There by Tommy Orange. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so this is the debut novel from a writer named Tommy Orange. He is one of the graduates of a relatively new MFA program at the Institute of American Indian Arts in New Mexico. And as I understand it, the goal of this program was to really cultivate a new generation of Native American writers. And this book is an amazing look at Native American life through 12 different characters whose stories all collide at a powwow in Oakland.
Does it tell us a story about today's Native American youth, perhaps? Because I think that this is a community that's so undercovered just by the media, by publishing. Does it give us a sense of a different narrative.
Absolutely. And it really emphasizes the heterogeneity of this population, how it isn't easy to neatly tell a singular Native American story. These are very complicated, very diverse stories that are all beautifully interwoven.
Book number three, we have Pretty Things by, now you'll have to help me with the pronunciation here, Virginie Despentes.
I think it's Virginie Despentes.
Oh, well, then
French,
there we go.
French.
There we go.
But my French is my French is not great either. So this book was first published 20 years ago and is being re-released now by the Feminist Press. And it's kind of an interesting time for it. It's the story of twins. And like a lot of twin stories, there's kind of like the good twin, bad twin. There is the sexy twin and the frumpy twin. And this is a very sharp and very funny exploration of femininity and also misogyny. So there's a kind of wicked and subversive and kind of uncomfortable element to this book. The plot line involves mistaken identities or one twin kind of pretending to be the other. And I won't give too much away, but it's the kind of book that you devour pretty quickly.
So even though it's been published, it was published 20 years ago, it seems like it still has relevance today, particularly in this moment of gender and everything else that we're dealing with.
Absolutely. In the last few months, I found myself rethinking everything I thought I knew about gender. And this is one of those books that kind of, if your mind is already chewing these things over, gives it a big push in a way that feels fun.
That's important because I think we need some fun collectively. We need some fun. Book number four, Banthology, Stories from Banned Nations, edited by Sarah Cleave.
Shortly after President Trump announced his travel ban against people from Iraq, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen, the editors behind this book decided, you know, if you can't physically travel between countries, another way to travel is by reading. Reading it now, they are just potent reminders of the humanity of people from these places. This is a little book. You could read it on an airplane. You could read it on a flight very quickly, and it transports you.
Book number five, Air Traffic by Gregory Pardlow, and this is a memoir.
This is a memoir from a Pulitzer Prize winning poet. Gregory Pardlow won the Pulitzer in 2015. And this is a book that tells kind of two really incredible stories. One is, you know, the story of his complicated relationship with his father, who by all accounts was this brilliant, charismatic, larger-than-life person who was also deeply troubled. But there's a historical element to it as well, which is that a central element in his father's life took place in 1981 when he was part of the air traffic controller strike, this massive strike that ended in this huge showdown with President Reagan and really changed the future of labor organizing in America. So that's kind of the backdrop for this. But what Pardlow is really doing is examining the ways in which his father shaped him for better and for worse in some ways. He's a really fantastic writer. He writes like a poet with that richness of language and precision. And there's a real searching quality to this book.
Book number six, My Year of Rest and Relaxation. This one sounds like a book I'm really going to like. Otessa Moshfegh?
Yes, Otessa Moshfegh. So we've all had days where we just wanted to sort of stay in bed asleep all day. So the premise of this book, it just kind of takes that to its logical extreme. It's about a woman who is blonde, tall, thin, independently wealthy, more or less successful, but miserable, and decides she's going to find a psychiatrist to help her set up this routine of medications that'll basically keep her asleep for as much of the day as possible. I'm laughing because it's a very funny book. It sounds so dark, and it is dark. But Otessa Moshfegh really plays up the absurd here.
You mentioned earlier that the news cycle and the publishing cycle are not exactly the same. Do you expect us to see a lot more books about this current political cycle that we're in, given that that discrepancy?
I think absolutely. I think these things have a way of just sort of creeping into novelist work. The last couple of years, there's also been a big rise of interest in dystopian fiction. and also speaks to the general state of mind that a lot of creative people find themselves in at the moment.
I wonder sometimes about the fascination with dystopian life right now, because I'm thinking it's a little too similar sometimes to real life.
It's not the escape that you want your reading to bring you.
Definitely not for the summer, I'll tell you that. Listeners, you can get Mythili's whole list on our website, and you can check that out at thetakeaway.org. Mythili Rao is a producer at the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks so much, Mythili.
Tanzina, this was fun.
This is Cindy Robinov from Grafton, Massachusetts, and I just bought 6 books for my summer reading, including Elizabeth Strout's Anything is Possible, Anne Patchett's Commonwealth.
This is Mark Mannheimer. I'm calling from Bradford, Massachusetts. I'm currently reading Michael Pollan's Magnificent, How to Change Your Mind. I have Adam Becker's What is Real, which is a further looks into quantum theory, from Simon Perry's Making Sense, Cognition, Computing, Art, and Environment. I expect to be moved, intrigued, and challenged all summer.
This is Jeff Todd from East Liverpool, Ohio, and after devouring the first 2 volumes of the King Killer Chronicles by Patrick Rothfuss, I hope that we get the 3rd this summer, tentatively titled Doors of Stone, but we don't know that for sure yet.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.